Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. And it has been a wild few days in the Champions League. Liverpool and Real Madrid have booked themselves a Parisian showdown on May 28th. Jurgen Klopp's charges had to survive an ambush from Villarreal's yellow submarine, and Manchester City found themselves absolutely, positively carletto'd in Madrid. Pep Guardiola ends another season in Manchester with European failure. Part one of today's show is reaction to back-to-back thrillers in the Champions League semis and getting some immediate reaction and hot takes, as always, ahead of the final. In part two, we're going to be keeping up the Liverpool theme. Spurs go to Anfield in Premier League action this weekend, and we'll be powering up the Squawker Talker comparison matrix to see who actually has the most potent front three based on some pretty awesome attacking data from both sets of players. And then to wrap it up, we'll be featuring our Game to Watch segment. Real Betis aiming to keep their Champions League hopes alive on Saturday night against Barcelona. And we also get a chance to see Manuel Pellegrini dripping in that tracksuit once again. So we're going to jump straight in. My name's Fergal Brennan, and as always, we have Squawker's chief football writer, Mohamed Butt. Mo, I'm delighted but also terrified to get your take on what happened in Madrid last night. But before we get into that, are you okay? Did you get some sleep? Is the blood pressure down?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. Had a lovely Eid, at the weekend. It was nice. It was nice. Came back to two very dramatic games of European football with some ridiculous comebacks. I've just about calmed down after the last two games. Hopefully tonight is going to be ordinary, but recording on Thursday, and West Ham, we're going to play Frankfurt. Another comeback on the cards for a Premier League. Who knows? We've had Premier League side come back. We've had Premier League side come back on, and now are we going to have another Premier League comeback, or is it just going to be Bundesliga dominance in the Europa League? Let's see. Oh, and Leicester playing Roma. Don't forget that.
It's been an absolutely ridiculous couple of days. Alongside Mo, we have La Liga expert with a smile as big as any of Carlo's Cuban cigars, Alan Feely. Alan, how are we doing?
Very good, Fergal. Like Mo, really enjoyed the last few nights of football. Blown away by last night in particular. The adrenaline is, still coursing through my veins, to be perfectly honest with you. Looking forward to tonight's action, especially Roma and Leicester at a packed Stadio Olimpico. That's going to be a really good one, I think. A really interesting game. And then the Premier League action and La Liga action coming back this weekend too. So yeah, we're to the business end of the season now, and I'm enjoying every minute of it.
Brilliant stuff. Right, we're going to get stuck into Real Madrid, Manchester City straight off the bat. Mo, I can't make sense of this. That's why I'm going to throw this over to you to try and make some sort of sense of it. It just keep going back to the same thing. Manchester City were not 5 minutes away from the final. They were five added time minutes away from the final. And that is massively, massively relevant here. But Rodrigo popped up twice to just send them into a tailspin. And then the killer, Karim Benzema, with a penalty and extra time to put them out. There's so much focus on Manchester City and another season of Champions League failure at the Etihad for Pep Guardiola. But this is just what Carlo Ancelotti does. He is the coolest cat in the business in these situations. And it's Real Madrid against Liverpool, again, in a Champions League final in Paris.
It's what Real Madrid do, man. This is, if you recall the Zidane era, people, specifically 2015-16, 2017-18, okay, the middle season, 2016-17, they were legit just the best team in Europe. They had that beautiful purple away kit. Cristiano scored 17 Champions League goals. They were phenomenal, right? And that was fair play, right? You can't. But in the first and last runs into the Champions League, they did this all the time. They were like rubbish, and then suddenly just said, no, we're not going to be rubbish. And then they just conjured something. I know it. They lost 2-0 to Wolfsburg away, 3-0 at home, comeback. They played Man City in the semi-final, and like they won in late with us. They won without even scoring a goal. They won 1-0 with an own goal from Fernando, I think it was. Gareth Bale shot it, deflected it against Man City, of all people, in the semi-final. And then in the final, they scored, what was it? Like a Ramos scored from a free kick that shouldn't have been a free kick, and he was offside, and then went to penalties, and then they just destroyed them on penalty. Yeah, it's Madrid, man. 2017-18 all the time. They pull it out of the fire. You cannot beat this. The only team that seems to understand how to beat Real Madrid is Barcelona, because when you put one past them, no. Put two, put three, put four, and then you're safe. If it's 4-0, you're just about safe, right? Although Zaragoza, you know, that's 15 years ago now, but Zaragoza diced with that particular prospect, for those with long memories. But yeah, Madrid, they just come back. If you leave them alive, they're like Jason or Freddy Voorhees or Michael Myers. If you just hit them with something and they fall down, they're not dead. Don't you have to cut them up, burn the body, salt the earth, and then maybe they won't get back up. Because if you knock him down, you're like, oh yeah, we got him, he's down. You turn around, he's just like Undertaker, just sitting up, and you're like smiling to yourself, and then just whomp in the back of your head. They're just incredible. Their mental strength is off the charts. It's their self-belief is off the charts. And okay, because it's not all just belief, right? They have the best goalie in the world, and they have the best striker in the world. Now, when you have those two things, and you have unreal mental strength, and you have great players, obviously, right? You can win. You can win almost any game if the luck is with you. So Madrid have had a lot of luck with them. Last night, for example, the referee gave everything their way, all the 50-50s, you know, everything went their way, right? But that's not enough to win games. You can have all the luck go for you and still lose, right? But then they had Courtois in amazing form, making endless saves against Man City, denying Man City. The only goal they put past him was the most ridiculous finish from Riyad Mahrez, right? Jack Grealish almost did a Ronaldinho 2005 on Real Madrid twice, right? Diced up their whole defense, made Danny Carvajal look like an idiot, and then boom, Courtois saves Mendy off the line. Did it again 5 seconds later. Boom, Courtois saves again, right? Massive, enormous saves, because then literally like 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, Danny Carvajal pops up, in comes the cross, you know, Benzema flicks it back. And this is the thing. It's so funny. And I just want to bring it up quickly, just one thing on Man City. I feel so bad for Jack Grealish, because this guy almost comes on and scores one of the greatest goals in Champions League history this season, gets saved, clear off the line. No one scores another great goal, nothing. All he's going to be remembered for from this tie is not making a 5-yard sprint to close out Danny Carvajal on that cross right at the end of the game. Just, yeah, that's the difference between a Champions League final for Man City and Real Madrid possibly winning their 14th Champions League. Just make a 5-yard sprint. Just make a fight. It's not difficult. You're not tired. You came on like with 10 minutes to go. Make that sprint. Make that sprint, £100 million man, and your team is in the Champions League final. You know, it's little details like that. Real Madrid never failed to make that sprint. They will never, like, that Benzema assist for Rodrigo's goal. There's no way, and most players are chasing that. They're like, that's gone. He's not only chases it, he has the technique to whip his foot around it, bring it back in, Rodrigo finishes, right? Because he believes, he knows, if I get to that, think about how many goals Real Madrid score from those crosses over to the far post, and then they just, someone's running back there. There's always someone back. Think about how many teams put crosses at the far post, and it just goes out of play for a throw-in. Never with Real Madrid, because they believe in themselves so much. They're always chasing around the back. Always around the back. Someone knocking it back. Casemiro and Ramos have scored, I don't know how many goals from that sort of thing happening. Cristiano Ronaldo too. Benzema has scored them himself, and then last night set one for Rodrigo. And the winning goal was just a cross and a knock on, and Rodrigo was in a great position. Really good. Laporte should have done better at the near post, been a bigger presence. Or frankly, Edison should have been Madrid won from like, they scored like three, I think they had like four shots on target, five shots on target the whole game. Like, make a save, Edison. Look, in the end, you have to discredit Real Madrid. They've done it three times in a row. They've played well. They've played 540 minutes of Champions League knockout football. They've played well for maybe an hour of that. 60 out of 540. And they're in the final. This is the beauty and the insanity and the madness of the Champions League.
It's page one of how to get through in the Champions League knockouts, and Real Madrid have essentially wrote the book on it. As for Jack Grealish, I'm sure Stefan Savic will be sending him a sympathy card when he gets round to it. Right, Alan, I want to throw across to you before we move on to Villarreal and Liverpool and that game from Tuesday night, which was also ridiculous. Substitutions was the big topic at the end of the game. Pep Guardiola's changes and Carlo Ancelotti's changes. And for different reasons, at the point in time when they were made, fans of the two teams would have questioned them. Pep Guardiola took off Kevin De Bruyne, who's their best player, their most potent attacking force. He brought on Jack Grealish, Fernandinho and Ilkay Gundogan. And then in comparison, Carlo Ancelotti took off his whole midfield, Luka Modric, Casemiro and Toni Kroos. His change paid off. Eduardo Camavinga was excellent and Rodrigo got two goals to basically drive Real Madrid into the final. Is this a different angle of Real Madrid? Because we're so used to those three names and Benzema and Courtois and goal, Carvajal at the back, Sergio Ramos previously, that Real Madrid actually now have another gear. They're not just going to old man their way to the final. They've got Camavinga, they've got Rodrigo, and they've got Vinicius Junior.
Yeah, definitely. I think the thing is as well that it was kind of predictable. I mean, I think everyone knew that given Joao Cancelo and Kyle Walker were going to be back for this leg, that Carlo wasn't going to start Rodrigo and Vinicius together. He was going to start Fede out in the right wing and bring in Casemiro into the centre midfield because Fede offers more defensive solidity and would kind of protect Cancelo from his marauding runs and that kind of thing. He'd shadow him and all that kind of stuff. And then it was kind of logical, I guess, that as the game wore on, Toni Kroos would make way first because I think he's not had a poor season. He's a very good player still, but he has looked a bit off the pace at times, especially in the latter stages of games. And, you know, we saw against Chelsea, he came off. He wasn't very happy. He came off against Sevilla as well at the Sanchez-Pizjuan earlier this month. And I think it's becoming a thing now where it's accepting. He's accepting his kind of role in terms of he's a player who start games, who control games, but he will make way. Carlo will make that call with him. And Camavinga offers something very different to what he does. I mean, he can carry the ball forward. He can run from deep. He can, you know, create opportunities through sheer enthusiasm and drive. And that's a very rare trait from players at that level of the game, at that age as well, only 19 years of age. So I think it was logical bringing him on. It was logical bringing on Rodrigo as well. The midfield was completely different by the end of the game. And I think it's kind of, you know, symptomatic of a changing of the guard at Real Madrid, because at the end of the day, it was these players who won the game for Carlo. It wasn't the, you know, sacred trident in many ways. So it was significant for sure. But I think, you know, a lot was made yesterday of, you know, Madrid's will to win and their drive and their ambition and their self-belief. And that was absolutely the driving influence in terms of what got them over the line and what got them to win the game. But I think that it was juxtaposed against Carlo's cool-headedness because he made big calls, you know, taking off Luka Modric. If that went wrong, and Eduardo Alvarez, who's a, you know, pretty well-informed voice in Real Madrid, mentioned this. He said, when he took off Modric, I was shouting expletives at the TV. I was making up new curse words, but because it worked out, you know, he's a genius, and that's the way it is. Like, I mean, Carlo made a big call by taking off those players, and it paid off because he knew what the game needed at that moment. City were kind of, you know, beginning to drop back a bit. They're beginning to buck a little bit. You know, we know their mental fragility is what it is. We know Real Madrid live off the hasta el final mentality. So, you know, once you have energy and enthusiasm and fearlessness in the pitch, which is what those players bring, it was always going to change the dynamic of the game. And it did in spades, you know. So I think it was very, very good management from Carlo to make those decisions when he made them, because he knows he can trust these players to come in and do a job, you know.
Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about Villarreal Liverpool. And Alan, I'm going to throw straight back to you on this, because this was, to, you know, bang the cliche drum, a game of two halves. It really, really was in every possible definition that you could think of. And Liverpool really struggled in the first 45 minutes. Two goals for Villarreal put them level on aggregate at the break. But the most impressive number from a Villarreal perspective, from a defensive perspective, was just how effectively they nullified Liverpool. 0.06 XG in the first 45 minutes in Castellón. That's the lowest Liverpool in over two seasons. That's an incredible feat for Villarreal, and knocking in two goals at the other end. And the strange structure that Unai Emery went with was essentially four central midfielders strung across the middle of the pitch. Three of them probably filed under whatever Premier League players. Etienne Capoue in particular was excellent, but he went with Giovanni Lo Celso and Francis Coquelin as wide midfielders to occupy the space that Trent Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson want. And then also Pareko and Capoue drop in to make sure that that fast ball from Van Dijk into Salah, into Mane, just didn't work. This was a brilliant tactical performance from Emre, but the law of the jungle won out and Klopp and Liverpool are into the final.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think they set up quite intelligently. But that's what Emre does, you know. I mean, I don't really buy the narrative that he's an underrated coach, because I don't think he is. I think we all know that he's a very good tournament coach in terms of FA Cup, are cup games or European games. He's remarkably skilled at those games because he watches, you know, 60 hours of footage of the opposition. He creates certain plans and systems in place that take into account the whole 180 minutes as opposed to just 90 minutes. And that's, he can approach these games with a level of thoroughness that you can't do in a league campaign, a 38-game league campaign. And that's what the skill set is. I mean, his failings in league football are well documented. I mean, Villarreal wouldn't have been in the Champions League last season were it not for them winning the Europa League. They would have been in the European Conference League. And this season, they're not even in that position. They're in seventh place. They're playing Real Sociedad in the Conference League position and Betis in the Europa League position. So they're miles off the pace. And they could actually get usurped by Athletic Club this weekend should results go their way. So, you know, their league form leaves that to be desired. I mean, it's highly impressive what he's done with this team in Europe. I think it's very, very impressive. But I think that has to be taken into account as well in terms of the league form. But in this game, yeah, I was shocked, to be honest with you, in the way Liverpool started the game. I mean, I think the Villarreal set up very well with those narrow four midfielders. It definitely was effective in a rattle Liverpool. But I still don't think that was enough to explain how poor Liverpool were. Because, I mean, they literally couldn't complete a pass. They looked completely uncertain. They looked completely shaky. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, to be honest with you. And when it went to 2-0 on the night, I genuinely was rubbing my eyes in disbelief. Then I think, though, to Liverpool's credit, to come out in the second half and compartmentalise what happened in the first half, put it behind them and attack again, I think it was just the mark of real, you know, elite footballers. I think it was absolutely incredible, genuinely amazing. Like, you know, so while I think that Villarreal approached the game correctly in terms of the tie, because they're an inferior football team to Liverpool, they had their moments. It was a risk worth taking, especially in the second leg, the way they played. I think fundamentally this was Liverpool being below par in that first half and then regaining their true selves in the second half. And when Liverpool were fully motoring, I don't think there was any chance that Villarreal could ever live with them, because you're just, you know, levels above them as a football team.
We saw with Inter in the round of 16, I think Liverpool, there is a degree of complacency in there when they have a lead. When they have a lead that they're comfortable protecting, they sort of not complacent in the sense that they stop. They just, I think they go into a sort of containment mode where they're like, yeah, we're winning, we'll see out the game sort of thing. And, you know, Gini Wijnaldum isn't playing for them anymore, so they can't do that. There, you know, there is a hole in that midfield where Wijnaldum and Henderson and Fabinho would just shut teams down before, because it was basically three defensive midfielders ahead of a back four. And you could hold on to a 1-0 lead or a 2-0 lead and just grind out and be really boring. But Liverpool have got Thiago in, they've got Naby Keita in there. They play different football now. They're a different kind of team. They play this really high line now, you know, really aggressive. So they're not built the same way they were 2 years ago, where they could grind out these wins. And so now they try and do it, I think, and it doesn't really, it's not really as functional. And if your team is very aggressive and tactically disciplined, and as Inter were, as Villarreal were, you can catch them. You catch them slipping. And that's what they did. Credit to them. But yeah, like you said, once they put their foot down, it was once they brought Luis Diaz on, once they started actually really going at Villarreal, it's you're not living with them. There's only one team in the world that's better than Liverpool right now, and they just bowled it to Real Madrid. So, you know, yeah, Liverpool are a phenomenal side, and it's going to, I mean, Real Madrid have a job on in the final to stop them, but then, frankly, Real Madrid don't even need, as we've seen three times now, they don't need to play well to win a game. They can give it 20 minutes, 10 minutes, and they'll still win the Champions League. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if somehow Liverpool, like, dominate the game final, outplay Real Madrid, and then Real Madrid instead of walk away with their 14th European title, because that's just what they do.
Yep, indeed. The stage is all set for Benzema in Paris. It is Liverpool against Real Madrid yet again. It is Carlo Ancelotti against Liverpool again. And he's already stoked the fires by claiming this is just an extension of the Merseyside derby. So he's got the Evertonians, including Alan, on his side in Paris. Right, we're going to have a little break. Champions League reaction is all in the can, all polished off. Liverpool, Real Madrid, toe-to-toe in the final. Right, up next, we are creaking open the door to the squawker comparison matrix. We're still talking about Liverpool as Tottenham go to Anfield this weekend. Liverpool have to win to keep Manchester City honest in the Premier League title race, but the comparison matrix will be giving us the answers as to who has the best front three. Will it be Klopp's Reds, or will it be Conte's Spurs? All will be revealed in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. The Champions League final is confirmed. Real Madrid up against Liverpool. And we're continuing the Liverpool theme in the second part of the show as we kickstart the Squawker comparison matrix. Now, Liverpool's front three has been sensational this season. Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, and generally one of either Luis Diaz or Diogo Jota. Spurs' own attacking unit has been refreshed in January. Son Heung-min and Harry Kane, we know they've got a brilliant partnership, but the addition of Dejan Kulusevski has added another gear to Conte and to Spurs. But before we start, and before we, you know, get into the debate about who's got the best front three and what's the data and the makeup behind that, I've got a couple of quiz questions for you. So, Mo, I'm going to go to you first, and we're talking about per 90 minutes. Now, Salah is the dominant guy in goals and assists, so we're going to look at some of the other stats before we start chatting about the situation at the respective clubs. So, take-ons. This is what we love. We love players getting the ball and skinning defenders. Liverpool's front three, Spurs' front three, who individually has got the best take-on success rate from the two front threes? Who is the take-on king, do you think? 0.63 per 90 minutes.
Does Luis Diaz, is he part of the front threes?
Correct.
Then he's Luis Diaz.
You've answered the question with a question.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, if it was him, then it's him. If it's not him, I don't know who it would be, but it definitely was him. He's the dribbler. He's the,
better than Neymar, according to Jason Cundy.
Yeah, and Jason Cundy's never been wrong about anything. So we're going to give Alan a go. See how you get on with these quiz questions. So we're going to go with chances created. Now, Luis Diaz is top for this, but he's only top by 0.1 point. Who is second in behind him on 2.19? Just behind Luis Diaz on chances created per 90 minutes this season.
Harry Kane?
No, Mo's won the trivia round, so it's 1-0 to Mo. It's actually Son Heung-min. He's just behind Luis Diaz based on per 90 minutes numbers so far. Right, we're going to get stuck into this now because this is a really interesting game in store at Anfield this weekend, Mo, because Liverpool have been incredible, both in the Premier League and in the Champions League in the last few weeks. And Spurs find themselves in a completely different battle. They're battling just to get into the Champions League. But they do have a brilliant front three. Kulusevski, Kane and Son, and particularly Kane and Son, we know the partnership that they've got. So I'm going to touch on Spurs first and the impact of Dejan Kulusevski. Since he's come to the club in January, nobody has more Premier League assists than Dejan Kulusevski. 8 Premier League assists in just over 2 months worth of games. That is seriously impressive. And Son and Kane are so experienced in the Premier League, but to throw a wild card in like Dejan Kulusevski, it's just been absolute mayhem because Kane and Son are so brilliant already.
In a way, it's exactly what Liverpool did with Luis Diaz. It's you've got these two strikers, essentially. I mean, I know Son is a winger, but he's a wing forward, right? You've got these goal scorers and you just put a pure winger in with them, right? Someone who loves to dribble, who loves to create. And it works brilliantly. The chemistry is great. Now, I mean, you know, there's some obviously more to it than just that, but it is boiled down to just that. They put a creative winger in, who's fast, who can dribble, who can cross, in with two guys who score loads of goals. I mean, it's not, do you know what I mean? It sounds so simple when you put it like that, but it is so simple because, you know, when you identify the right kind of players, and I'm sure Conte had a massive hand in saying, all right, I want that guy, right? I'm sure Conte had a huge hand in it because he's a Conte-esque, very Conte player. You know, they got this guy, they got the man they need, and he's doing the business. Liverpool did something similar with Luis Diaz, where I think Spurs were interested in Luis Diaz as well, weren't they? And so, because again, they clearly wanted that dribbler type, right? So then Liverpool, like, oh no, we wanted Luis Diaz in the summer, we'll have to get him now. And they got him now, they got their man because they know that they want a dribbler type. And we'll talk more about them in a minute. But with Spurs, it's just, look, you've got in Son, you've got one of the best movers off the ball in the Premier League, right? Fantastic, runs off the ball, runs into space, great timing, great pace, great skill, positionally intelligent, very, very, very positionally intelligent. And then a great finisher off either foot, very, very good. And then in Kane, you've got one of the best players in the league, phenomenal all-round player, can play as a number 10, can play as a number 9, long-range passing ridiculous, short-range passing ridiculous, chemistry, flicks, hold up the ball, can get into the box and score from almost anywhere, left foot, right foot, even with his head. Yeah, you know, you've got two of these two, let's call it world-class forwards, right? And you've put a player that's actually close to their level with them now. They've never played with anyone that good. Well, not since Eriksen really was there. And this is just a perfect sort of chemistry, a perfect harmony for Spurs. And they look good as a, and like, you know, if you'd said 3-4 months ago that, oh yeah, Spurs are going to give Liverpool a game at Anfield, you'd think, I don't know. But now you're saying it, it doesn't seem so impossible.
Alan, I want to ask you about Luis Diaz, because inevitably him and Dejan Kulusevski are going to be compared together, because they're the January arrivals. They're the next level, as Mo said, that's been thrown in to an already established attacking unit. And one of my favourite things about Luis Diaz is that he's such a throwback to that position. He's almost a 4-4-2 winger playing in an attacking front three. And his big numbers, where he's the best of the six or seven players that play regularly across the front three, are all connected to winger type things. He's top for take-ons completed, he's top for take-ons attempted, 4.3 and 2.77. And that type of just give me the ball and I will get past any fullback that you put in front of me, he's brilliant against Villarreal in midweek. We've seen, particularly coming off the bench in the Champions League, he's sensational. Dejan Kulusevski has been brilliant, and the numbers do show that. But Luis Diaz has been transformative for Liverpool so far.
I think that, you know, the numbers back him up, but I think Luis Diaz is special in a way that numbers can't convey. I think that, you know, similar to a Rory Smith piece he did with Thiago Alcantara after the first league against Villarreal, it's like the numbers back it up, but the numbers aren't the point. You know, the point is that Luis Diaz is the player who gets you off your seat, the way he takes on a man, the fearlessness with which he does it, you know, the ability to beat a man, to create fear in the opponent. It's a really invaluable trait. You know, he reminds me almost of, and I never saw this guy live, obviously, but, you know, Gaincha, the Brazilian Botafogo winger, who was kind of famed for that ability. And he's similar in many ways. He's kind of quite a spindly frame, you know, not exactly a Cristiano Ronaldo type figure, but so quick, so strong, so wiry, you know, from humble background in Colombia, from an indigenous community in one of the poorest parts of the country. You know, quite a difficult career path to get to where he is today. He's just a phenomenon, you know. I think he completely changed the game against Villarreal when he came on, because he did something that, you know, I think is rare in top level football. And he comes on and his presence is exponentially more beneficial for the team, because he has an ability to inspire fear in the opponent. And when you have fullbacks who are, you know, hence up to that point, quite content with how things were going, they were quite controlled, did the game under wraps. But when he comes on and you've players, you know, terrified that he's going to make the wrong decision, because you know that the man is going to get behind you, and if he gets behind you, you're not going to catch him. Or he knows that, you know, he's making a run around you and you're afraid to, you know, try and close down the man who has the ball, because you're aware that Luis Diaz, if he gets the ball, will not miscontrol it. He will get in behind and he will either shoot or get the ball across the face of goal. It's a remarkable trait, you know, and he really is a throwback. And like I said, while the numbers back it up, it's the, you know, the instinctual things that get me about him. He's a really exciting player to watch. One of the best first touches I've seen in a long time, just in terms of the way he can control the ball in different ways. He's a frightening player, and I've never seen a player slot into a team as easily as he has. I mean, we talk about the adaptation process for players coming from foreign countries, especially, you know, a league like Portugal, which isn't maybe in the top three in Europe. But he's been seamless. He's been absolutely electric, and he's a frightening prospect. And I know Kulusevski is a very good player as well, but I think that Diaz is in a class of his own, to be honest with you.
I mean, given the rate and the speed at which Bruno Fernandes, Ruben Dias, and now Luis Diaz have adapted to Premier League, we might have to start reconsidering how we view the Portuguese league. You know what I mean? Like, this is three of the best players, yeah, most dynamic players that have come into the Premier League recently, and they come from Portugal. Luis Diaz is phenomenal. And the reason why he's so effective is because he does something that only Mohamed Salah does in that Liverpool team, is he dribbles the ball. The best way to beat a low block, the best way to beat a team that's stuck in and defending, is either crossing to the big striker, right, which Liverpool don't have someone really. I mean, they have good headers of the ball, but realistically, you know, Jota and Mane are waiting for defenders to make mistakes rather than just going to, you know, win a header in the air or win a 50-50 duel like Ronaldo used to do for Real Madrid, for instance, or Benzema does for Real Madrid. Or if you're not going to cross into the big man, like that's Real Madrid's MO, you need a dribble, you need to beat a man. And that's what Luis Diaz does. He beats a man. And Mohamed Salah does that too. But then if Mohamed Salah does it, you can commit more of your defenders over to Mohamed Salah's side and 1v1 Sadio Mane, for instance, or Diogo Jota, right? But if Luis, if Diaz can dribble the same way that Mohamed Salah can dribble, who are you doubling up on? No one. You can't really do that. So you're 1v1 every time, and that creates better dribbling opportunities for Luis Diaz, Mohamed Salah. It's, you know, it's a massive difference. And it was like, I mean, for years we watched Lionel Messi do it. The greatest way to upset an opposition is to just dribble past a man. You shatter marking schemes. Liverpool, Villarreal went basically man for man against Liverpool in the first half in the Madrigal. That's why they did so well. You bring on a dribbler, that completely destroys man to man marking. You can't mark man to man if you've got a guy who takes one guy completely out of the equation, and then everything goes chaos, right? Because then everyone's man to man marking. Who goes and marks the guy who just got free by dribbling? You know, what do you do? So it's, yeah. And also what he's done, Luis Diaz, is he's allowed Sadio Mane to play centrally, because Mane was looking like he was flagging, right? His Liverpool career wasn't really, he seemed to have hit a wall, right? And as a left winger, and, you know, because Firmino wasn't there anymore. Liverpool rejigged their whole team. They used to have that front three, Firmino, Salah, Mane, and Firmino was the attacking creative hub, because you had three midfielders of defensive midfielders, Henderson, Wijnaldum, and Fabinho, right? Or Henderson, Wijnaldum, and Milner, whatever. It was always workhorses, right? And so the creativity came from Firmino, and Mane used to come in. He would drop deep, Mane would run in beyond, score goals, so on and so forth. They've rejigged it since the introduction of Thiago. Means there's more creativity in midfield, and Klopp is also increasingly playing a second creative player in midfield. So, you know, Naby Keita or whoever. I mean, they're looking quite like Guardiola-esque at times. You know, Pep hashtag Pep won. Pep always wins, even when he loses. His team lose. you know, so they're playing more creativity in midfield. So that means Firmino can come out of the team, which means you put Diogo Jota in, the arch poacher, the little Michael Owen, who's popping up in the box here and there, banging in goals. So that means Mane as a left winger is like, well, what am I doing with myself now? I'm not really the hub of the team. The hub of the team is still moving through Trent and Salah, obviously. But like the balls are not getting to me in the same sort of way they used to be. What am I doing in the team? So he dropped off. But then the introduction of Luis Diaz instead of Diogo Jota puts Mane back into that central role, where he effectively just plays the same way he did in left wing, but just from a central position. And look at the numbers, right? Now, admittedly, before I say this, he's played 2,430 minutes in the Premier League and Champions League as a left winger. He's played 685 minutes in the Champions League and Premier League as a centre forward. But still, per 90 minutes, 0.39 goals scored as a winger, 0.92 goals scored as a forward, right? 0.04 assists, 0.13 assists as a forward, right? Shots, like 3.55 as a forward, only 2.87 as a winger. Shots on target is more. Shooting accuracy is higher. Big chances scored is high, way up, like 0.39 as a winger. Big chances scored as a forward, 0.79. Like big, he's even creating more in, not much really, big chances. What's gone down is his dribbles. Obviously not much, but he's not dribbling as much as he was because, of course, Luis Diaz is doing that, right? It's just transformed Sadio Mane, given him a whole new lease of life, and allowed him to continue to do what he was doing, like, but as a winger. Now he's more involved in the game. Passes attempted, he's almost doubled his passes attempted from 29.44 to 42.44 in the time he's playing centre forward, right? More completed, more final third. Everything has gone up because he's seeing the ball a lot more and using it more and linking the play a bit more in the same way that Firmino. He's not new Bobby Firmino, but in the same way that Firmino used to see the ball a lot, Mane's now seeing the ball more as a centre forward, and he's seeing it in more dangerous positions. And the goals scored is just the biggest factor. He's scoring more goals now because he's back into goal scoring positions, and because defenders are so occupied with the two guys either side that can dribble, that can beat a man, and it's terrifying. So it's the most. You know, it's a brilliant signing, Luis Diaz. And it just goes to show that when you add a great player to a great team, the great player, even if he's not necessarily world-class, he doesn't have to be world-class. If he does something very well that your squad needs, he can have a world-class effect on the team. So, you know, not a world-class player, but a world-class impact on the side. And Luis Diaz is the ultimate example of that. Liverpool for me. He's 25 years old. He's not a world-class player. He's scored 14 goals in 18 games for Porto this season. Very, very impressive, but he's not a world-class player. But he's having a world-class effect for Liverpool because he does what the other forwards don't do well, except for Salah. And it's completely energised and lifted the team. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I would agree with Mane. I think my kind of two pence on the situation is this shows the brilliance of Sadio Mane and Jurgen Klopp, because by bringing Diogo Jota in, he essentially solved a problem that Liverpool didn't know they had with Roberto Firmino, his advancing years, his injury problems. Jota's come in, seamlessly improved Liverpool. And then again with Diaz coming in, he solved a problem that they didn't know Liverpool had either, because Luis Diaz has taken Liverpool onto another level. And for me, the big numbers surrounding Sadio Mane have come since Luis Diaz has come in. 28 shot-creating actions in the 8 games that they've both completed 90 minutes together, where he's played centrally and Luis Diaz has played out wide. This shows, for me, that Sadio Mane is the most adaptable forward in the Premier League and potentially even in Europe. He can be an elite-level operator out wide on the left, and he's just as good through the middle. He just basically just processes a different skill set. You want to play me here? I'll be incredible. You want to play me here? I'll be incredible. And that is why Sadio Mane, for my money, he's the most adaptable forward in the Premier League. He's absolutely sensational. And just when we thought, is there another gear to him? Can he do this? Is his Liverpool career potentially flagging? He said, you know what? I'll just pop inside and I'll become a world-class centre forward. So before we wrap up, we're going to do a little bit of a comparison switcheroo and try and decide what is the best combination. So, Alan, we'll go to you first. If you've got $1 billion in the bank or $2 billion in the bank, who is your ideal front three from Spurs and Liverpool to go and dominate world football?
Oof. I'd start Harry Kane centrally. I play Mo Salah off the right side. And I think I would play Son on the left. I think Son is underrated. With the conversation last week, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I think Son is underrated because he's Korean. And for other reasons, I think Son is a really consistent world-class performer. So I think that if you're looking at a trio, that's the trio I would go for. Harry Kane through the middle as a 9.5. And then Son coming in off the left and Mo coming in off the right.
Same thing, same front three. It's the best front three there is. You've got Salah as one of the best players in the world, and you've got Kane and Son, who are the best duo in the world. Their chemistry is off the charts. Son, as we world-class forward. Harry Kane, world-class forward. Mohamed Salah, world-class forward. And so, yeah, that's the front three. Like, chemistry-wise, sure, maybe someone like Luis Diaz would probably fit in with Kane and Son better. Like, you know, we actually see Kulusevski, right? A winger, a dribbler, who creator would fit in maybe better chemistry-wise. But Mohamed Salah can dribble, can create. He's also can score 30, whatever the hell it is, goals. So, yeah, he's one of the best players in the world. So you put him in there, and then you have Kane and Son and their chemistry. And then, yeah, that's the best front three that you could have combined as a three of the two clubs. I mean, it's probably the best front three combined you could have in the Premier League. I can't think of anyone else I'd rather put in that front three, to be honest. Have those three up front. Bruno Fernandes, Thiago and Rodri in central midfield. Oh, De Bruyne as well. Bruno Fernandes and De Bruyne, and then Thiago Holder midfield. You know, Trent and Robbo on the fullbacks. You know, or Trent and Cancelo maybe. You know, who's in defence? Virgil? Matip maybe? You know, stick Alisson in goal. Come on, that's a beautiful team.
It is indeed. You've basically just built the Liverpool team with a couple of exceptions. So we're going to call it there on the comparison matrix. We're going to slam the door, because I think if we go any further with this, we're just messing with science and building teams that would probably take over the world and just destroy football through their absolute brilliance. Right. But we are going to take a little break. After the break, we're wrapping up with our game to watch segment. And we're switching to Alan's stomping ground, Spain and La Liga. The title race has been confirmed. Real Madrid are Spanish champions, but the battle for the top four rages on. Real Betis are the Copa del Rey champions, but they're up against it as they want to get into the top four. Barcelona are their opponents this weekend. We'll be getting Alan's take on that game and why you should be tuning in this weekend. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. And we're wrapping up the show today with our game to watch this weekend. And it's Real Betis at home to Barcelona that we've picked. Alan, naturally, we're going to throw to you on this one, because the La Liga title race, as we know, is over. Carlo Ancelotti has masterminded the title for Real Madrid. But the top four battle has still got a fair bit of road to run, and it's far from decided who from Spain will be playing in the Champions League next season. Now, Real Betis have already had their success so far this season, Copa del Rey champions, but they want to be in the Champions League. Manuel Pellegrini has said it. It's not since 2006 that they've been in the Champions League. However, and this is the equivalent, you can throw some light on this, a Monday night away at Getafe is the most Premier League wet Wednesday at Stoke that you can imagine in La Liga. And Pellegrini and Betis slipped up, 0-0 draw, and now they're really up against it to get into the top four, and Barcelona are in town this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, but I wouldn't think they're up against it though, because I don't think they're looking at it that way. I think that they're looking at it as a free hit, basically. I think that Betis' season was based on the Copa. All season they've been singing basically, you know, Tienes que ganar la Copa. The song about, you know, you have to go and win the cup. That's what we want. We want trophy. We want a silverware. That's what the club needs after 17 years of nothing. And they went and did that. They won the Copa del Rey in penalties against Valencia at La Cartuja in Seville 2 weeks ago. The city was crazy for an entire weekend. Absolute madness. The streets were jam-packed. And that's their season completed, basically. But the message after that game from Sergio Canales, from Manuel Pellegrini, from Joaquin, from all the senior leaders in the dressing room was always that the season isn't done. It's completed in the sense, but it's not done. We have five finals left to go and play, and we want to get top four football this season. We believe we can. Obviously, you know, going to Getafe on Monday night in the Alfonso Coliseum, the Alfonso Perez, was a difficult place to go. Quique Sanchez-Flores set up his team for, you know, very cogently and very intelligently. Played with a low block, difficult to break down, frustrated Betis, and they came away with a point. So while it's not ideal, because that point, you know, could have been three, and if they had gotten three, they would have gone within 1 point of Atletico Madrid heading into this weekend. They're now level on points at Atletico. If they win against Barca, they go level on points at Atletico just before Atletico play Madrid the following evening. So I wouldn't say it's completely gone. I think they're outsiders for sure, but, you know, the difference between them and from Atletico and also Sevilla is that both Atletico and Sevilla have to finish in the top four. Their budget is based entirely around finishing in the top four. If Atletico don't finish the top four, they have to renegotiate a contract with Diego Simeone. It's in the clause. It's in the written contract. They have to sell a couple of, you know, high-earning players. So the pressure is on. Whereas with Betis, there's no pressure whatsoever. It's a free hit for them. They're playing without fear. At the Benito Villamarín, they'll be completely full, 60,000 people. You know, it's Ferry this week in Sevilla, which means every single day of the week there's, you know, these street parties going on, amazing atmosphere in the city, and the sun is shining. So come Saturday at 9 p.m, there'll be, you know, 60,000 pretty boozed up. Betico is going to the stadium, rowdy, ready to celebrate their heroes coming back from the La Cartuja with the trophy and looking to do damage against a Barcelona team who are, you know, undoubtedly making progress under Xavi Hernandez, but aren't exactly convincing at the moment. Without Pedri, they're a different animal. So while, yeah, they're an outside bet this Saturday night and for the top four race in general, I think if you compare their trajectory and their, you know, situations to Sevilla's and to Atletico Madrid's, there's a chance, a big chance. It's whether they'll take it or not is the issue.
I don't want to pour cold water on that because I love Betis and they're great and they're fantastic. But this is a team that has scored precisely two goals in their last five, three goals in their last five games. Like, and two of those against Cadiz a month ago. Then 0-0 against Real, 1-0 loss to Elche. They got 1-1 draw against Valencia in the Copa del Rey final, and then they drew 0-0 with Real Betis. This is not a team that scores a lot of goals lately. They're struggling right now. I don't know why. Kwame's sort of gone off the boil goal scoring wise, and Borja Iglesias isn't. I mean, he was great in the Copa del Rey final, by the way, if you watch that, but he's not necessarily the most all round player. Fekir's going through a bit of a lean spell. Canales, you know, so it's. They've played brilliantly all season to get to where they've been, but they're just hitting a bit of a wall now. However, the festival atmosphere, the fact that it's Barcelona, there's no Gerard Piqué probably this weekend. That's going to help because it means Eric Garcia is going to play. And I mean, Borja Iglesias. I mean, look, Ronald Araujo is going to play too, and Ronald Araujo could handle Borja Iglesias. But if Borja Iglesias can sort of move across a little bit, it's little Eric Garcia, 2 foot tall, you know, is the reason Barcelona are out of the Europa League, Eric Garcia. So, you know, he's definitely a weak point to be picked on. Borja Iglesias, I mean, he could probably eat Eric Garcia for lunch. So, you know, there's definitely a chance. Jordi Alba's been defending very well, sure. Ronda Rousey's very good. Danny Alves will play right back. Danny Alves is a weak spot too, technically, but he's also really good with the ball, so it kind of balances out. But yeah, if Eric Garcia is playing, which I'm pretty sure he will have to, because I don't think Piqué is going to play, that's a big weak point. But look, even if Barcelona win, and let's also be clear about this, Barcelona are very good at Real Betis, away to Real Betis. They won their 2-3, 3-2 early last season, 3-2 the season before, 4-1 the season before that, 5-0 the season before that. Like, the last loss in Betis was, I mean, I don't even remember when it was. When was it? 2011 in the league. You know, they do well in Betis. Betis have won a couple of games at the Camp Nou, including earlier this season, by the way. But if it's in Xavi's first loss on him, but in the Benito Villamarin, Barca tend to do well. They tend to be high-scoring games too, so it's good fun. You better tune in for this. It's going to be good. There's going to be goals. But the thing is, even if Barca win, and I do think Barca will get the win, spoiler alert, look at the fixtures left between Atletico Madrid and Real Betis, right? Real Betis have got them with Barcelona. Then they're facing Valencia away, which, I mean, a rematch from the Copa, and they should have won the Copa much more handily than they did, so they should win that. Then they're playing Granada, and then they've got to play Real Madrid. But it's Real Madrid who have already won La Liga. It will be the last game of the season. They'll play their B team, if that, ahead of the Champions League final. So that should be an easy win for Real Betis. And they do well at the Bernabeu anyway, to be fair. Look at Atletico Madrid's fixtures. They're playing Real Madrid this weekend. They're going to lose that, because they always do. Then they're playing Elche. Okay, fine. Then they've got to play Sevilla. Then they've got to play Real Sociedad. Atletico's fixtures are nasty, and they're not in good form either. They've won one of their last five. They've scored, again, two goals in their last five games. 1-0 against the 1-0 loss to Mallorca, 0-0 Man City, 2-1 lost to Espanyol, 2-1 they beat Espanyol, 0-0 against Granada, 2-0 to Athletic Bilbao. They're not in good form either. They look like they're flagging as well. And again, the fact that they're playing Real Madrid this weekend means that basically, even if Betis lose, nothing's going to change for them, right? They're going to still have that 3-point deficit. And again, looking at those fixtures, the real worry for Betis should be Real Sociedad, who are 2 points behind them. Then Real Sociedad, if you know anything about Spanish football, you know that don't worry about Real Sociedad at the end of the season when it comes to consistency and holding their bottle. They might pull a qualifier game or two and do well. They're not going to do well enough over four games. Even a four-game stretch is probably a bit too much for them come crunch time. And that's very sad because they play great football, but let's be realistic. When it comes to the season, the top four itself, as much as it pains me to say it, because you got to love Atletico Madrid in the Champions League, they really wind everybody up. I think Betis will get top four. I think Atletico, their fixtures are too difficult. I think they'll drop too many points, and I think they'll bottle their way out of it, and Betis will get top four for the first time since 2006. And won't that be lovely?
Yeah, 2005 actually, it was 2004, 2005. It was the same year they won the cup, they got top four. So they played in the Champions League 2005, 2006, the following season. But I think you're right with the goal scoring thing, Mo, but I do think the mitigating factor is that they were thinking about the Copa. And I know that we always say it doesn't affect teams, but it does. I mean, I saw them play Elche, Villamarine the Tuesday before the Saturday Copa, and, you know, it was a tentative performance. Whereas I think now, got the hangover out of their system after, you know, the Getafe game. They're playing at the Benito Villamarín. I'll be there myself in the flesh. It's going to be 30 degrees in Seville. It's going to be a special atmosphere.
They'll get a Pasilla, right, as well. Barca will give them a Pasilla for winning the Copa as well, probably, as well, right? And they'll present it before the fans. So, yeah, maybe you've got a point.
I'd imagine so. It would be like, I think the conditions will be perfect for them. That's what I'll say. I think that I can see Barcelona winning the game, of course, because Barcelona are a superior football team to Betis. But I think given the momentum of each team and the moment of the season and what they have to play for, what's at stake, I think Betis could have a chance. They could shake off the cobwebs, but we'll see. We'll see.
Definitely watch it. There's going to be goals. I don't like to guarantee goals because then it never turns out 0-0. But there's no way in hell this game is ending 0-0.
Great stuff indeed. As always, here on the Squawker Talker podcast, we're here every single week with a big talking point. And with the Premier League and the Champions League still massively exciting this season, we'll be here all the way until the end of the campaign. Hit subscribe and you can check out the new episode as soon as it is ready. Thanks for listening and speak to you soon.